Committee on Education and General Government. I want to open an informational meeting on the, what we've been doing with the Higher Education Work Group, and call up Dana Richardson and Chancellor George Persteiner to give us an overview. And Senator Morris and I are also on that task force, and make sure everybody's on board with what we're doing there. Morning.
Good morning. For the record, Dana Richardson, the Legislative Director for Senate President Peter Courtney, and I staffed the Higher Education Work Group. And two of the three of you up there were on that, so I'll just talk to Senator Bonamy.
This is all for you.
Yesterday, the work group met for what would be the last time, as far as we know, and approved three LCs that are before you today. One puts the 40-40-20 goals into statute. It also kind of updates some of the goal language that's in statute for higher education. That's LC 1287. LC 992, we focused on the dual credit issue, how you get high school students better prepared coming into community college or four-year institutions with some credit already under their belts. We really built off in that draft, this is LC 992, the reset cabinet recommendations. And by 2014, we're requiring districts to offer access to accelerated college credit programs. And another one of the key pieces that the reset cabinet identified that we wanted to try and address was that oftentimes there aren't teachers who have kind of the credentials that they need to provide this instruction to high school and still have it qualify for getting credit in the 2 or 4 year system. So we proposed a kind of a grant program that would be, it would require buy-in from the school district, the student teacher, the preparing teacher, and then the state, with the three would come together to put resources into getting the additional credentials for teachers to be able to teach the stuff that gets the kids moving ahead. And then there's the big one. I suspect LC 2861 is not copied for everyone up there. It's about 300 pages.
And I did copy.
Did you really?
One through 44. Because anything after that was miscellaneous. So I think the substance was in the...
Well, the critical operative dates at the end are January 1st, 2012. And then there's an E clause on there, too, at the very end. But the main pieces of that LC are that it incorporates a lot of what the Oregon University System proposal is, and the Chancellor obviously is here, and he can talk more about that. And then the additional piece that the work group identified was a real lack of a statewide body that looked at what was going on in two-year institutions, four-year institutions, as well as OHSU, and in our workforce development programs. And so the proposal is a higher education coordinating commission that would develop a statewide strategic vision for higher education, helping identify where our needs are, how we can get there. The commission would work on a financing model and really be kind of the legislature and the governor's eyes and ears, and working with all of the higher education sector to identify how we can get to where we need to get. OHSU is not really directly involved in that, but they would provide information so that the coordination occurs. It doesn't change the local board structures at community colleges. It really is intended to be a coordinating commission, not a governance commission. And I will just leave it there, I think, for questions. If I'm leaving the big pieces out, I'm sure the work group members up there will point them out.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for your help and bringing that whole effort together. Chancellor, your take on the product of task force?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, George Persteiner with the Oregon University System, and I apologize in advance if my voice gives out in the middle of all this, but that you probably don't want to hear me for very long anyway. So. Thank you for this opportunity. I am really excited about the product of the work group, and I'll tell you why. And I'm excited about each of the three bills, not just LC 2861. It's important to set in statute the goal we are trying to achieve as a state, to set our aspirations in a way that's congruent with where we believe the state and its citizens need to be in order to be successful. And that's really what the first LC 1287 does. It says, as a state, for us to be successful, our citizens need to have a level of education that is competitive with the best in the world. And that's what LC 1287 does. And I appreciate that. It is actually the framework with it in which our board developed our governance proposal. It was to find a way to achieve that goal that the board, in looking at the financial situation of the state and of the system over the next several years, said, we need to make a change in order to stay on track to meet that goal. So I think it's very, very compatible with the approach that we've been taking, and I applaud the work group for taking that issue on and suggesting it be placed in statute. LC 992 is, as I have mentioned in prior sessions, a very important bill. And the reason is that we have the opportunity to use the time that students and teachers have in the last couple of years of high school to help meet our overall state goals for education. We have determined through the surveys that we have done over the last umpteen years that students who reach us with 28 credit hours of AP, IB, or dual credit are almost certainly going to graduate from college and going to graduate in 4 years. I mean, it is an amazing opportunity we can provide to students for lower cost, more success, and that really does fit well with LC 1287's goals. And so I think the two work together well as a policy framework for how we will go forward. And, of course, LC 2861 is the one I want to spend a little bit more time on because it, in fact, as it's come out of the work group, is very similar in many respects to what the State Board of Higher Education has proposed as a governance change, changing the status of the universities from being that of a state agency to that of a public university system. That's one piece. Another piece is to change the relationship between this body and the universities to be one that focuses on performance and outcomes, that focuses on things like degrees granted, that focuses on things like affordability for Oregonians, that focuses on things like enrollment of Oregonians. The board, as it took a look at what it would take to meet the 40-40-20 goals and to meet them in a way that ensured that students and people in every part of the state and in every socio-demographic group within the state had both equal access and the opportunity for equal success in terms of reaching degrees. Those motivated the board to come up with the proposal that is embedded in LC 2861. Much of it deals with efficiencies, such as in the risk management area, but much of it deals with the ability of the universities to be able to manage the tuition dollars that are provided by the students for their education in order to ensure that education is successfully obtained for those students. That's all embedded in LC 2861. I think it will keep us, even in these dire financial times, on course to maintain the record enrollments that we have had, the record levels of student achievement we have had, and keep us on a path that could lead to us getting much, much closer to 40-40-20 than perhaps we ever could have done if we just did business as usual. In fact, I'm sure that it will get us much closer than we ever will have done with business as usual. So I really appreciate the work of Chair Haas and the other members of the committee and of Dana Richardson and the other staff of the committee. They moved this forward in a very short period of time, and I think it will have long-lasting positive effects for Oregon and for Oregonians, and I thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Morse, you were a member of the task force.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dana, for all your hard work on this and legislative council. You know, I come at this issue from a business background, and one thing, just as a general statement, one thing that I have learned over time is that if you're going to achieve the highest degree of efficiency and effectiveness, you do it by delegating responsibility and authority to their broadest practical levels. And that fits within my framework of how do you get the greatest effectiveness and efficiency. And this bill does that. And I find it interesting on the day that we're meeting, the emergency board is meeting at the same time. Agenda item number 11 is withholding tuition dollars, $17 million from expenditure limitation. And that just fundamentally is not right. And appropriation of interest earned on tuition dollars is fundamentally wrong. Those are student dollars invested by their parents and by the students themselves to buy an education, not to fund other aspects of government. And this legislation will correct that. And I wholeheartedly endorse this draft and look forward to having those meaningful discussions in our committee as we move this bill forward.
Yeah, the notion is that we should, if we're not going to give you more money, we should at least give you more flexibility and freedom to compete against those other universities out there that already have that in other states. Any other comments from the Higher Education Task Force or for the Chancellor or Dana? Senator Bonamici?
I want to thank you for all of your work on this. Obviously, want to take some time. I've not had the privilege of sitting through all the discussions, but thank you. I know this is very important work, and I know you've spent a lot of time on it, and I look forward to reviewing the draft and having the discussion as we go forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, as promised, we were going to introduce, have this committee introduce that legislation, and we have that at the end of the agenda here, but I see no reason, for ceremonial purposes at least, not to do it right now. So if you would do the honors here, Senator, I'm going to close the informational hearing and open up a work session for purposes of introducing our higher ed bills and our other bills.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll move these three bills as one. I move that LC 1287, LC 992, and LC 2861, and I don't see a date on these. Do we have a date on the LC, or is it important to reference the date?
Only if there's more than one version.
Yeah. Well, we'll move those bills that be introduced as committee bills.
Okay. And as always, support doesn't imply any support for the bill, just for introduction purposes. Any objection? Seeing none, then these pieces of legislation will be introduced into the 2011 legislative session. Thank you, guys. And I'm going to move to an informational hearing on ESDs. And we have a work group, some folks here who are gathered. Representative Comp was pulling this group together, but I also see some familiar faces. Sandy Husk, Doug Casty, Chuck Bennett.
Good. How are you?
Now, our committee has already introduced one bill to corral ESDs, if you will, and it won't be the only one, of course, and that's why you're here today. So, go ahead.
Okay. You want to go first?
I will, if you'd like
to. Yeah, that'd be great.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chairman, my name's Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. pardon me, Mr. Chairman. As you know, we've been working on this issue now for a number of years, and really intensely over the past year. We've had a we have a representative assembly of school superintendents called our, we call it our Funding Coalition Steering Committee. It's representative by size, geography, the whole nine yards, and they have been dealing with this issue off and on over the past year. And what we found in the discussion, number one, is this is a very complicated issue. It's a very difficult issue to find any kind of state-level solutions. We certainly admire that legislators are putting in bills that would have state-level impact, but the difficulty is trying to find the solution that works in Harney County and works in Marion County. It is, there are very large differences. And so I think before going into specifics, I want to just sort of express from the perspective of someone who's been watching this, not as an educator, but as someone who interacts with policymakers regarding these issues, that just to advise you very carefully, and I hope you'll take it to heart, is a one size does not fit all out there on ESDs. I think you're going to have to take this on in pieces, particularly looking at geography, size of districts, district relationships with their ESDs, and that I think is probably the most challenging aspect of this, and one that makes it so difficult to deal with at the state level. That said, though, we do think there are some universal changes that can be made, and I would call your attention to Representative Comp's bill draft, which reflects a number of changes that we are very interested in and have been discussing. Part of the problem in developing these kinds of policies is making sure that we guarantee that the ESDs continue to be available to districts to augment their educational goals and individual student goals. As you know, Mr. Chairman, the ESDs provide invaluable service to local districts around the state, trying to meet state and federal law, state and federal mandates, particularly dealing with at-risk and special needs children, in addition to other services. And I think often we get ourselves caught up in the other services, the business office, the transportation, the kind of, it's great to talk about, but ultimately, as you know, Mr. Chairman, our mission is related to the education of an individual children, and ESDs provide an enormous service in that way. But as you look at providing those kinds of services, I'd call your attention to the bill draft, LC 2208, which came out of Representative Comp's work group. And I know she'll speak to her own bill draft, but I want to kind of underscore, in advance of her testimony, those areas that are of real interest to us. We are extremely, in talking with superintendents and asking them to kind of come to some sort of conclusion relative to ESDs, there is substantial interest in high flexibility for school districts using dollars that are available to them, the resolution dollars, kind of the ESD money that's moving through the system. That is probably one of the most radical changes that we have been able to come up with at this point, is that school districts really need to be able to take those resolution dollars and spend them where they see the service best provided. And that is going to require some legislative change. It's also going to be the kind of thing that I think results in what has been the objective of many legislators, which is seeing regional services defined in terms of services, not always in terms of just region, where you're not just confined into a ESD boundary. We are very supportive of that approach and certainly recommend that portion of the bill to you for consideration. That doesn't mean there won't be changes. What I've discovered in working on this issue is every time you meet with folks, it changes, and that kind of brings me, or attitudes seem to change as people think about these issues and consider the consequences of decisions. And a good example is that portion of the bill that would change the board makeup. We have discussed that a number of times with our funding coalition, again, this representative assembly of superintendents. And at various times, superintendents statewide have said, yes, we would like to be on the board of our local ESD. We'd like to serve as the budget committee, those kinds of suggestions that are included in LC 2208. Then at subsequent meetings, I think as people sort of stopped and thought about what the implications of that are, we have a, there'll be kind of a shift, and I'm kind of waiting for that one to get pinned down. But there has been real interest in, I think, a more involved role for school districts in their local ESD, and that the current board configuration, pulling in members of the public to oversee ESDs as opposed to those who are the customers of ESDs, which are local school district, has some issues and would like to have that looked at. I can't tell you exactly where we end up. And similarly with their budget committees. So I hope I've kind of dealt with that. I would suggest also add, Mr. Chairman, because the issue comes up regularly, is a real concern about just messing with ESD funding by, as you recall, currently ESDs get 4.75% of the state school fund, and that's the funding that's being worked with inside the ESDs. And I've seen various proposals, and I'm sure you will as time passes if they haven't already made it into the hopper and onto your desk, recognizing that you'll be looking at it, to eliminate or to cut 0.75 of the 4.75 and assign it to some sort of either specific program or remove it from the system. And I would just assure you, Mr. Chairman, that at this point, we're real concerned about that approach, depending on how that 0.75 is dealt with. And I bring it up because I've seen it and heard about it just enough times. What we don't need this next session is some sort of real shift of funds away from the education system, away from direct student services, which is what those represent in many cases with ESDs. And we certainly don't need to see them transferred onto a new program that would be more appropriately funded in some other way. We're just real concerned about it.
Okay, thank you. We do have the two reps
good
working on this. Representative Compton and Representative Berger, if you want to come up. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Just stand by, Chuck.
I haven't spoken yet. Okay.
Welcome. We got going a little bit early for you.
Thank you, members of the Senate. For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative. I represent the Salem area. I'm a former school board member who have, frankly, even when I was on the school board, had issues around ESDs. And in my particular ESD, the Willamette ESD, is sort of ground zero for the public nature of problems around this system. But in investigating, it is certainly a deeper issue than just the Willamette ESD. And what I kind of look at and how I think of this is a sort of a Gordian knot of, at one end, you have the services that you want and you think are being provided, and at the other end is the sort of money flow. And if you pull on the knot, you don't get, you get into the knot, but you never get to the direct line of where it all goes. And as we go into a period, this has been a problem for quite a while, but as we go into a period of great scarcity, we as policymakers need to be able to pull on the string and know exactly sort of where the money goes in the service delivery system. And that brings us to the place we are now, in my opinion, which is we need, since a lot of the dollars in the state go into the educational piece, need to be able to sort of take the system apart and find out where the knots are. A very wise person in my hearing within the last 24 hours said, maybe it's been repeated in this room, if we were starting from scratch, this is not the system we would build. That was from your chair, Senator Haas, yesterday, and he is exactly correct. But there is great panic that we're going to just take apart the system and don't know what we're going to get to. So we are at a critical juncture. I in terms of the current sort of thinking about where we should be going, I commend to you my superintendent, who has great knowledge of other systems, other communities. She isn't like grown up in the system the way a lot of the people in Oregon are. They can't imagine anything else because this is the system we built. And as she is a very good educational thinker and policy person, my concern going forward is that we cannot delay. That's why we're here, is to get started on what will be a very, very difficult process, as I think you already know. So I am going to defer to my colleague on the Education Committee, which I do not serve on. But I do follow the numbers. I do follow ed policy, and I want to be at the table to help untie this knot as we go forward, because it's incumbent on us to do it. It has to happen, and it has to happen now. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go to Representative Coffin and ask a question.
I'd rather have Sandy have an opportunity to say her.
Okay. Superintendent Huss.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments, Vicki. I'm not sure I'm good or great at anything, but I appreciate the support and encouragement. I'll do better today now that I've been motivated. And Senator Haas, members of the committee, I really appreciate the chance to speak on this important topic again. You made a statement at the end of the topic right before this one that said, if we're not going to be able to give you more money. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Sandy Haas, superintendent of Salem-Keizer School District. If we're not going to give you more money, we at least need to give you the flexibility to compete. And that is exactly where I think we are on this topic. We need the flexibility to be able to compete. Salem-Keizer is the second largest district in the state. We have 40,000 students. I've been the superintendent there. This is my fifth year. I have participated in the WESD conversations. I've also participated in conversations around this topic from many other ESD perspectives across the state. And I've taken it recently to start visiting some of the smaller school systems that do rely so heavily on ESD support so that I can understand the issue from their perspective as well. And I think that when I first started talking about this, it was the language I was using is that Salem-Keizer wanted to be able to opt out. I believe a more accurate description now would be to say Salem-Keizer would like to be able to opt in, that we want to partner with our partnering school districts. We want to partner with ESDs across the state. We want to partner with other school districts that are our size, that have similar student demographics, that are solving a lot of the same problems. But we don't want to be forced to buy. And we particularly don't want to be forced to buy services where they are redundant or not helpful and not working directly with students. I used this analogy last time I was here, and I'm going to use it one more time, but more briefly. For large school districts, going to the ESD is like going to a grocery store where you're being forced to shop. The store might not have what you want, but you still have to shop there. If you choose nothing, they put things in your cart anyway. And once all of your food money has been put together and you go to check out, they deduct the cost of the items in the cart plus some overhead. And then the remainder of your food money can only be given to you if you can prove to them that you're using it wisely, which is very difficult to understand, particularly in the current circumstances with the WESD and where they are. one size doesn't fit all. I mentioned our size. We're one of 21 districts in the WESD. Just as an example, there are other districts that are the size of Perrydale with 319 students, St. Paul with 266, and Falls City with 142. They're not necessarily as remote and isolated as some of the other small districts in the state in our rural areas, and yet we still try to find ways to bring everybody together and talk about sharing and partnering. In the Willamette Valley, I mentioned the geography because in the Willamette Valley, it is very possible for districts of smaller size to think about sharing services across district lines because we don't have the remote issue to struggle with the way some of our colleagues do in other parts of the state. We have resources in Salem-Keizer that the smaller systems may not at this point have. Let me just give you an example. One of the things that all school districts want is a robust curriculum. And we spend money on curriculum in two ways. One is we spend money to design it, to develop it. And then we spend money to help teachers learn how to implement the curriculum. The design does not need to be done in two different large systems. You don't need to do curriculum design in Salem-Keizer and then redo it at the WESD. So an example of partnering would be for us to say where that work has already been designed, we have the capacity to just offer it. And then the ESD can focus on, for the systems that are smaller, how do they want to combine their interests so that they can figure out how to implement it. That's an example of what I mean by partnering. Special education is a little different. In special education, they are directly providing the service to the students. And that's a case where I think partnering probably is not going to work as cleanly. We're going to provide special education services to our students. The WESD for high-needs kids will probably be providing it to most of the other 20 districts. Citizens expect accountability. Local control is something that's near and dear to the hearts of Oregonians and to me as well. Local control and accountability, I believe, is better served for large systems if we choose to opt in rather than being forced to take core services because of a vote. I have to mention with pride that we have passed all mandatory audits in Salem-Keizer with flying colors for many, many years. We voluntarily undergo many other audits. We have a quality assurance model that we have in place, and we pay money. We're going to be audited next week to get ISO 9001 certification. We have other audits that we bring in to say, is this a well-functioning business? Are there things in our processes and procedures that we could improve upon? Our ESD, unfortunately, has struggled to complete their audits. And yet money is distributed to them for our students. It goes there instead of remaining within Salem-Keizer. So in conclusion, I think that running money through another layer of bureaucracy does not make sense for larger systems. I do want to repeat that our interest in partnering continues to be high. We are empathetic with other systems and the struggles that they have, and we'll continue to work with them. But that I believe it should be up to each district to determine what our needs are. And I think there's a lot of potential in this particular bill, and I'm very pleased to have seen it this morning. We need a change in the service model. We need to be sure we're continually providing better service to students. And again, I thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wonder, Superintendent Husk, if other superintendents of similarly sized districts share your views, if you know. Thank you.
I believe they do. But I believe that the difference in the specific topic would be what is the quality of service that they figured out through their partnership with their particular ESD. And that's why I agree with the comments that Chuck Bennett made, that you really do have to look at the circumstances, not just of the geography, but of the trust level. I think that's the unique difference right now.
Thank you.
One of the fundamental issues that we've had for years is You could do all of these services that you get from your ESD on your own because of your size.
Almost all of them.
Mm-hmm. And so could Beaverton, and so could Portland. Perrydale is different. We know that. But and so we need to set up an arrangement for the Perrydales of the world. Mm-hmm. But that still begs the question, why do we have ESDs for Portland and Salem-Keizer and Beaverton?
Correct.
It does seem like a a duplication of services. And I know they'll argue, well, we do certain things. Well, there's nothing that the MESD does in Portland that can't be done within the Portland School District and save 58 administrative jobs at MESD. And for every one of those jobs, I think it's been told we could hire three special needs instructors. I mean, that's the whole point of all of this discussion.
Yeah, and if you look at models in other states, Representative Berger mentioned that there are models, whether it's a BOCES or an ESD or an ESC, where the large systems stand alone, mm-hmm. and the smaller systems that need that kind of a central service work together to share their capital, so to speak, across district lines.
So the opt-out approach, which is somewhat different than this bill that is in front of us, is one that, you know, gets to that a little bit. If you want to stay within this current ESD system, so you would opt out, and you would then get the money that would normally go to the ESDs, and you hire your own special needs instructors and mm-hmm. and all of that. I understand that it's necessarily complicated and it's a thorny tax patch to figure out. But while it's complicated, it's not impossible. It can be done. Representative Kahn.
Thank you, Chair Haas. For the record, my name is Betty Comp. I reside in Woodburn, Oregon, and have the honor to serve House District 22, which is Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and North Salem. Just what I want to do is share some process steps with you so that the committee has an understanding of how we got to where we are. And the other part of this is we certainly aren't there yet, and we have lots of work to do and lots of voices to listen to. We had a bill, the bill that Senator Haas brought forward in last session that passed the Senate chamber, got to the House, and for a number of reasons was unsuccessful to pass the House. This has been an issue, a topic that many of us have been discussing, not for just 2 years, 4 years. It's been out there for a long time. Oh, at least 15. And so with the economic crisis that we're seeing right now, we are looking for efficiencies, how to get better results even than what we're currently getting for our dollars. And so several members right after the 2009 session were asked to serve on Governor Kulongoski's reset committee. That was Representative Roblin, Representative Berger, myself, and Senator Cruz. We met with ESD superintendents. Sandy met with us as a person that's in the field in a school district. We had members from the department, and we had one or two lobbyists in this group. My respected colleagues, I'm going to be a little blunt in my testimony this morning. We met for 9 to 10 months, and we accomplished nothing. We absolutely came away with no recommendations, nothing. So at that juncture, it was not our knowledge as a work group, but Governor Kulongoski developed a new reset committee on this topic. Also, some of us said, well, our job's not done. We need to do more work. And so several of us have been meeting. The core of us were the four that were on the original reset committee, plus then we asked Senator Haas, Representative Gelzer, to join us to make sure we were all on the same page. While that was happening, we have some excellent leadership in the field. We have a number of superintendents that have met and discussed this topic. Co-Chair Buckley took this discussion to his local superintendents in Southern Oregon just last week. There's been superintendent meetings in the different regions of the state. Over the past couple of years, we have seen consolidation of one Eastern Oregon ESD with another. The crux of some of the struggles as we move through this, the reality is that the 4.75 is statutorily required to give that to our ESDs as a portion of the state school fund. ESDs have state school fund, they have local funds, they have other funds, and they have federal funds. Yes, their property taxes. And when districts, when ESDs do want to consolidate, there's this whole discussion about these different funding sources from property taxes, Measure 50, Measure 5. How does that impact these communities? It has caused some communities with this recent consolidation for their tax rate to go up. And so it is not a situation that anybody moves lightly into. Therefore, what you have today in front of you are a couple of documents. You have the bill that Mr. Bennett was referring to. It was agreed upon in our small work group that the House would develop a governance bill, and the Senate would look at more of a fiscal bill. And about 2 weeks ago, I learned that the governor's office had recommendations, which is a document that you have received that's from Tim Nesbitt and Margie Lowe, and about what the Governor Kulongoski's office is suggesting. The governance bill that we brought forth from the House that was submitted as a committee bill on Tuesday is LC-2208. The governor's bill draft, which has an additional component to it, is LC-3122. And here in the governor's draft, he has that there would be a reduction in that 4.75% that goes to education service districts. And what I would share is in the last 2 weeks, I have had colleagues, all kinds of people, just general voice out in the communities of a representative. Are we going to reduce that to 4? Are we going to reduce it to 3? Are we going to reduce it to 2.5? Or are we going to cut it completely out? So that is a lead in to where do we go from here? And we met briefly our small work group yesterday, and we know that we have work to do. I think a critical step that we need to continue doing is reaching out to local superintendents of school districts of all shapes, sizes, and geographic dimensions. But in order for us to get a quality piece of legislation, we're going to need, probably some of us are going to need to work in January on this. We asked Sandy, who is so incredible, about what are some legal questions we might need to research before we can move any further. It's my understanding, and Chair Haas, you can share your perspective, but the bill we dropped in the House, 2208, has a relating clause. It lays an option out there to begin the dialogue, but it is not, at this point, anybody say this is what we have to do. It is again a beginning point so that we have a bill to work with and can amend, change as we get more voices engaged in this discussion. My final comment would be our schools and our students have waited too long for a system to support them, our teachers in the classroom, our students that need help. And we are at a time where we have a real responsibility, a moral responsibility, to see how these funds are being expended. If you ask, ESD superintendents, I would hope that they know how their money's being spent. But I know many school district superintendents, I've called them, contacted them, asked them, do you know how much money is going to your local education service district and what are the areas it's being expended? And I have had candid conversations with these superintendents, and they said, Betty, the funds are so commingled
nobody can figure it out because it's moving from line item to line item depending upon whether they're local funds, state funds, or grants. And so it is not a surprise to me that when McNomah ESD is audited, Willamette ESD is audited, and several in Eastern Oregon, that the business management of these institutions is flawed. And we can't reach good information that is so that it will guide us. So that's a barrier that we're under with this process. We don't have good information on how those dollars are directly impacting students. I have requested from the department 2 or 3 times the last 4 years, can you tell me how many students are being served by Willamette ESD in these contracted areas? And they never can provide us with a number. I think that's a minimum. If we're serving 5,000 special education students in first or second grade, I don't see how that should be so impossible to obtain that number and who's paying those costs. So some of those things may come out, and what I respectfully request at this stage is please help us look at this issue. Please give us any suggestions that you have. As you know, we can't meet with a larger group because then we'll have more people in the room than we should for public meetings law. But we can make different groups. We can address this issue in a number of ways. And yes, and I'm sincerely here to say I am committed to providing the best legislation we can as a body in both chambers session so that we know exactly why we're sending money to these institutions and how can we do it in a way that we know that our students are protected. I think we need to talk about phase-in steps if we're going to talk about loss of funds or loss of programs so that the local school districts do have the time to make those adjustments, whether it's in staffing, reorganization of some of their programs. I don't want to be a legislator that is mandating a change that is impossible to implement.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. We do want to avoid the disaster that was WESD. It seems like there's one at the end of every session saying, I wish we could have gone further on that bill. And that's what happens. These things get so complicated, and the Gordian knot is a perfect example of, and then we run out of time. And I think that's what happened last session, and we just can't let that happen. I think most Oregonians would be surprised to know that $900 million will go to ESDs in this biennium. Almost $1 billion for a part of the educational system that most people don't quite understand or even know about. And that, at the same time, is we're cutting teachers and in some cases even cutting school days. So any questions?
A lot of questions, Mr. Yeah. Chair, but I think this is not the time right. to get into that. But it begs a solution.
Yes, it does.
And that's an understatement.
And Senator Cruz has all the solutions.
I would like to make just a brief comment, Mr. Chair, if I could. Everything Representative Comp said is really spot on, but I would also suggest that trying to track dollars in other parts of the system is just as frustrating as it is in ESDs. And I've been a part of this work group for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And we keep trying to come up with solutions. I'm not sure. This is more complicated than a lot of people know, which we're now finding out. I think we're going to be asking some of the right legal questions on the front end. We still need some to look at if indeed we do this, how do we hold small schools harmless? Is that, do we have a separate line item outside the formula, or is there a formula adjustment which would indicate that we may have to do some redefinition of small schools? I mean, it's very complicated. But, Ms. Chair, I will let you know that in the work that we have been doing and in some of the legislation I am proposing, I have one objective only, and that's to put more dollars in the classroom, period. Everything else is irrelevant. We need more dollars in the classroom. That's it.
Thank you. And thank you. I still have on my list Doug Castee.
And committee Representative Berger and I are in Ways and Means, so I think we're going to get
back
there.
Don't spend any more money, okay?
Too late.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cassidy, thank you, sir.
Chair House, members of the committee, Doug Costi, Assistant Superintendent, Oregon Department of Education. Ed Dennis, Deputy Superintendent, sends his regards. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here today, so he asked me to recap the department's position on the ESD consolidation concepts. So with your permission, I'd like to give you a list of points that we would like to make in support of different aspects of the bill, the bills that have been floating around and the concepts. ODA, as you know, has participated in many conversations, including the Reset Committee, et cetera, on the future of ESDs. First point I'd like to make is that we support the concept of educational service districts and value the service they provide to districts. We also support the entrepreneurial model of allowing districts to purchase services outside of their region. We support the removal of the $1 million floor for the small ESDs. However, we believe, as other folks have indicated, that we need additional conversations on how to phase that in appropriately. We are in support of a review of the ESD governance structure, including the concept of allowing component district superintendent representation on ESD boards. We would like to call your attention to, we need to take a closer look at the open meeting laws to ensure that if districts are meeting, district superintendents are meeting under other venues and the topic of an ESD comes up, that we need to be clear on how they handle those situations. The fifth point I make is that we support withholding of state school fund monies if audits are not properly submitted. We also support greater transparency and accountability for ESDs, consistent with what you heard from Representative Comp about following the money, knowing how many kids are being served by the various services. We support the current ESD share of the state school fund. And ODE does not support allowing large districts to take their share of ESD allocation without reviewing the state school fund formula to address the equity issues that potentially could arise and harm smaller districts. And with me today is Brian Reeder. If you have any questions about the equity issue, he'll be available to ask them. To support our position, I just, you know, in addition to the work that ESDs do for the Department of Education, such as the regional programs, the early intervention, early childhood special education programs, professional development around the use of data to inform instruction, I wanted to call out some examples of some ways that ESDs are thinking out of the box to ensure that you understand or hear that they are working to try to make things differently. Next fiscal year, there are five ESDs in the Northwest region that are planning to implement a model that will allow component districts from their areas to choose where they purchase their services across the traditional boundaries, including technology, school improvement, help desk, and special education services. We made a call to a couple of districts in that I serve as a liaison to in Southern Oregon, Southern Oregon ESD and Douglas ESD, and asked them to, you know, if you had a minute, what would you say to the Senate committee on ways you're creating efficiencies and reducing redundancies. And you can see that there are three areas in Southern Oregon where they're trying to create these efficiencies through the use of centralizing technology in terms of audiovisual aids, such as smart boards, et cetera, network infrastructure, distance education, and media resources. Through special education, they're providing assistive technology, audiology, Braille-less interpreters, training, and professional development. In the area of school improvement, regional workshops, teacher mentoring, professional development in the use of data, attendance service, and the development of a reading work sample that can be consistently used across their region in support of the new high school diploma requirements. Douglas ESD has created several unique strategies to assist some of their smaller component districts as well. For smaller districts, and as needed, they have filled the role of superintendent, business manager, and HR director. 8 of their 13 districts have built a consortia to hire a special education director, and they serve as a technology director for 5 of their districts. So in summation, ODE supports ESDs and believes that as funds become tighter, ESD should be viewed as a solution, not a problem. Thank you.
I appreciate you I guess, putting a positive spin and some examples. Problem is there have been other examples, most recently, WESD, where millions and millions of dollars, taxpayer money, down the drain. Before that, 2 years ago, it was Multnomah, where an audit showed more of the same. Before that, it was a terrible situation in northeastern Oregon that involved the FBI even. That's really what we're trying to get at. And what I don't see in your comments here is, you know, here's how we're going to get at that. Here's how we're going to change that. Here's how we eliminate that. Nor really have I seen any proactive approach in terms of getting at those problem ESDs in terms of shutting them down, cleaning them up, the same way that the federal government might close down a bank. I realize you may not all have the statutory authority that you would like, but I just haven't seen that from the department. And so while I appreciate you saying that some ESDs are doing good work, and we all know that's true, we all know that we need to change things to prevent the next scandal. Questions?
And just a comment, I would suggest there have also been school districts that have gone upside down too. So to say that ESD is a unique thing that doesn't ever fall in on itself is probably not accurate. And the mechanisms for dealing with those school districts are also cumbersome and complicated. But the thing I would like to point out, and especially if you look at what Douglas is doing, there's some very positive things we could do here. And one of the things we talked about in the reset committee and since then is consolidation of administrative functions. And for example, I would submit that if we do appropriate consolidation, especially in small school districts, obviously there are economies of scale that play in here. But I would suggest that a small school district that has 250 students, if we had a consolidation of administrative functions, they don't necessarily need a superintendent anymore. They could get by with somebody to run the school. You know, there would be a significant savings there in that sort of consolidation. And I'm hoping as we move forward with this that we do look at the administrative functions, especially in small schools, and see where we can come up with efficiencies that once again, will drive more dollars to the classroom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to close down ESDs for now. The informational hearing, that is. Sorry. And open up a cheerier subject, Chess for Success. Are we all here?
I'm here. Can I make a comment? Is there coming forward, Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you for your cooperation in agreeing to put this item on the agenda at my request. I think the committee is going to find a refreshing change from big picture complex issues and really look at something that truly works for students. And as we're approaching times where we're going to have to learn how to do more with less, I think you're going to be impressed with what Chess for Success has been able to do for kids, especially kids in Title I low-income schools. You'll see, I think, some very positive things that are happening with our kids.
So. No, it's the night that moves like that.
And so I'd like to welcome Julie Young and Phil Margolin here. We know of you and your work and your other pursuit. And committee members, if you chill here and act the right way, my sense is we're going to be included in a passage in one of his books coming up, I think. That's how I'm playing.
I'm Phil Margolin. I'm a founder of the Chess program, Chess for Success, past president, and I'm currently on the board. This is our executive director, Julie Young. We did have a DVD we wanted to, it's about a two-minute DVD that we'd like to play, but does anyone know how to do
it? Is that possible?
We like movies.
I'm a technological idiot, so I'm not going to even touch it. So.
I think there's a screen thing.
Oh, okay.
The opportunity.
Ooh. That's not a good sign.
Incorrect desk.
Incorrect desk. That's not a good sign.
You either put it in too early or too late and all this.
Or upside down.
Yeah.
Upside down would be probably what I would do.
Usually the door doesn't close.
That's the right age.
Oh, that looks promising. Oh.
Okay, maybe we don't have the technology.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, you know, we're going to skip the movie. So. Julie and I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about this program. The first thing I always like to explain is that we are not a chess program. We're an educational program that uses chess to trick kids into learning study skills that are not just useful in school, but useful in life. When you take into account the outstanding documented results that we have and what it costs us to achieve them, I think it is very fair to say that we are one of the best educational programs in the state of Oregon. Now, in 2004, the Northwest Regional Education Lab received an award from the United States Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention to conduct a two-year evaluation, external evaluation of the program. And we are currently running chess clubs in 69 Title I elementary schools in 13 Oregon school districts and one district in Washington. Our average club's about 40 kids. We have a number that are well over 100. And we're serving about 2,800 children this year. We try to expand 5 to 9 schools a year, depending on our budget. And so, of course, we're adding more and more children every year. Now, we are presently, because of just budget, we had to make a decision on where to put the money that we make. We're a nonprofit. So we're just in Title I elementary schools. And as you know, those are the schools with the poorest kids and the ones that are not supposed to be succeeding academically. So here's the result of the 94-page study, which we can provide to you.
Somebody has it.
93% of the children in Chess for Success met or exceeded the state math standards compared to 88.6 statewide. That's a statistically significant difference. 91% of our kids met or exceeded the reading standards compared to 86% statewide. Again, statistically significant differences. Now, the lab also set up a comparison group, and our kids, 17% more of Chess for Success students exceeded the standards in math than the comparison group, 10% more in reading, and again, statistically significant differences. Now, what makes Chess for Success unusual, and I'm sure there are other types of programs that can get very good results, it's $75 per kid per year, and that's intentional. We have devised a system. We don't think you have to throw a lot of money to get amazing results, and we've devised a system starting 1992 when we were founded that keeps the cost per child very low but still achieves incredible results. Equally important, when school budgets are getting clobbered every year, we put 93% of the money that our nonprofit raises back into the schools. So what do we do to achieve these types of results? It's a really simple program. First of all, we pay a school teacher at the school that we're working in to run an after-school chess program twice a week. So that's money going back into the school system. We provide the sets and the boards to the school. We provide a chess library, about 5 books that are aimed at kids who are a little bit more interested in chess, want to learn a little bit more on their own. That goes into the school library, so more things that are going back to the school. Each kid that successfully completes the program gets their own set and board to keep. We also run a second program. We run the state elementary, middle school, and high school state championships. We have 25 regional tournaments around the state that are open to anyone. Homeschool, parochial school, private school. They have to pay an entry fee, which we then use to help fund our after-school program. Chess for Success kids do not pay a penny. As a matter of fact, this program is free to the school, free to the parents of the children, and free to the children. And the kids design T-shirts for their team, and then we provide those T-shirts for free to the kids. So they do the logos. I coached a team for years. So the Hayers talks, they pick the logo, but then we provide the free T-shirt for the kids. Now, here's the hardest part for me to explain to people, because you say, well, it's like an after-school chess program. My kids are in, you know, band, or they're in this. Why does this work when other types of programs don't? And it's really cool. Here's the deal. If you want to play chess correctly, you got to sit with your feet on the floor. You've got to focus your entire attention on the board. You can't talk. You can't look around. Now, here's the key to this deal. In most board games, a little kid spins a wheel or throws dice to figure out the move. After a certain number of moves in a game of chess, the number of potential moves are more than all the atoms in the universe. And what that means for an elementary school kid is that in most things like Candyland, you don't have to think to make your move. After certain moves in a game of chess, you're usually presented with 4 or 5 viable moves, none of which is exciting, none of which will dramatically alter the game. The consequences of the move don't turn up until several moves down the line. So this makes children look at consequences of actions and plan for the future. So what they have to do is they have to go through each move. If I move my rook, this could happen, this could happen, this could happen. Okay, but what happens here, what happens here? Okay, that seems interesting. What about if I move my bishop? Now, this can't be done quickly. And it forces a child, because they want to win the game, so they know if they pick the right moves, they'll win. It forces the child to sit calmly and unobjectively and unemotionally evaluate each potential move, and then recheck their conclusions when they're finished. Now, think about it. That is what an elementary school kid has to do to read a book with comprehension, solve math problems, take tests. Anything you do as a legislator, when you get a complex bill, if you sit with your feet on the floor, focus all of your attention on this bill, go through every possible solution and then recheck your conclusion, your chance of getting the right answer goes way up. If you're thinking about buying a house, I love this house emotionally, it's beautiful, but how much are property taxes? What's the mortgage? How much do I have in the bank? That's chess. So basically what we're teaching these kids to do is to sit quietly for long periods of time and focus. And if you do that, your chances of getting the right answer to your math problem go way up. Now, so the goal of Chess for Success basically is just to get kids to sit still and shut up. Now, it's a simple goal, but if you think about it, if you can get kids to do that, because most little kids have very short attention spans, you're really accomplishing a lot. Bill Gates made lots of money by developing MS-DOS. It is not a spreadsheet program or a solitaire program or a word processing program. It's a little gizmo in the computer that makes it possible to run these programs. Chess is MS-DOS for a little kid's brain. We don't teach them reading, we don't teach them math, but once they've got the gizmo in the back of their head, it's easier for them to learn all of these other things, and as you can see from the results of the study, it really does work. Another interesting thing about Chess for Success, it's the most diverse program in the universe. Now, I know it's a grandiose statement, but I've been challenging people for years to come up with any other program that is like this program. We are the only program I know of where first through fifth graders, boys and girls, talented and gifted average kids and special ed kids. We have a lot of special ed kids in the program. Kids with serious learning disabilities like attention deficit disorder, dyslexia. Kids with serious physical disabilities, wheelchair-bound kids. Kids with cerebral palsy and non-English speakers all work together on an equal playing field. It's a really amazing leveler. So another minor point, but an important one, internationally 5 to 10% of chess players are girls. We have 37% in our program. If you go to Cleveland, you go to New York, you go to L.A. and tell people involved in chess that there's a program in Oregon where 37% of the participants are girls, they'll say you're lying to them. Julie went to the first, she was invited to give a paper at the first international conference on chess and education in the University of Texas in Dallas a few years ago. She, by the way, she was one of two women at the conference, so it sort of supports my position. And that was one of the things that blew everyone away, the fact that we can get such huge numbers of girls. This year, we had the largest all-girl tournament in the country, 216 girls participated. We had to close down registration because of space. So just a little, another side thing. Chess raises self-esteem. If I told you that I have a six-year-old granddaughter, she's in first grade, and she's on the chess club, your immediate reaction is going to be, whoa, 200 IQ. This is absolutely false. Well, you have very few talented and gifted compared to the non-talented gifted kids. But chess has this aura of, as being for brilliant people. And so the kids, once they master chess, start thinking of themselves as being smart. Then they start thinking that they should be doing better in school if they're so smart. Their teachers look at them differently. You know, if Mary comes in and she's in the chess club, teacher says, whoa, I didn't think she's that bright. But if she's playing chess, maybe she is. And I'll tell you, I was a school teacher for years in the South Bronx, New York City. If you tell kids they're stupid, they will be stupid. You tell them they're smart, they will be smart. They live up to expectations. Peers start looking at the kids differently, and so do their parents. So the last thing I want to say to you before I turn this over to Julie is, as politicians, you will love this program. It is totally apolitical. We found it in 1992. We have never had a single complaint about the program. How many issues that you deal with can you say that you've never had anyone call you up and get mad at you for what you're doing? So it's a wonderful program, totally apolitical. Everybody loves it. And I'll let Julie take over from there.
Chair Haas and committee members, thank you for allowing us to be here. And also, we want to say a big thanks for, we received a grant in 2007 from the Department of Ed to fund a pilot in Eastern Oregon. It was our first pilot outside the Willamette Valley, and it was in Vail in Ontario. We started out in Vail. We started in three schools. We weren't sure. We had done a pilot down in Monmouth to test our theory that we could run a remote program. And the Vail program went beautifully. So the next year we started in three schools there. We added two in Ontario. And things just kept rolling from there. We served about 208 students that second year in those five schools, which is about our average. Usually at the beginning, we don't serve as many, and then clubs grow as the program is around for a while. In 2009, we added, because of that being so successful, we added seven more schools in Redmond. And the year we added in 2009 was the year that they went to a four-day school week, so they were absolutely thrilled to have the program. We were able to leverage that $50,000. We got $153,000 from that, an addition from individuals and private foundations, and we're able to add 17 more schools and adding another 2,100 kids to the program. So that grant had a very powerful impact. I put some comments about need and impact in here and gave you some information about a study about why kids drop out of high school. And there was a review of research that was 25 years of research, 203 studies that they studied, and they said one of the biggest predictors is poor academic achievement in elementary school. And as Phil said, our study proves that we can raise reading and math scores, and one of the comments that many people make is, well, of course, only the smart kids are in your CHESS program. That's not accurate. We had, and the study proved, we had kids in a bell curve, so it's not just the smart kids. In fact, special ed kids are in there, like Phil said. So we're addressing that issue. We're also addressing it. One of the other things that they found was that active participation in extracurricular activities is a predictor of graduation. And we provide not only an after-school program, but it's fun, it's nurturing, it's a safe place for them to be. It's free and open to all the students. And it's taught by a school teacher in their school, so they see that positive adult role model every day in the hallway. So it's somebody they can go to if they have problems. Closing the academic achievement gaps in low-income children and minority students is a big issue. And CHESS for Success is addressing that issue also. We serve very large numbers of low-income and minority students. Right now, our schools are 71% free and reduced lunch. The districts that we serve, that we are in, are 56%. So we're higher than the districts. The minority students in our schools, we have 50%, and those individual school districts, the schools in those districts are 43%, so we're serving actually more minorities than our percentage-wise than the district. Also, the essential skills that were adopted by the Oregon State Board of Education for requirements for graduation, we are addressing, and I attached a letter from Steve Rosenfeld, who has been a teacher in Portland Public Schools for 32 years and was a coach for us for 17 years. He addresses that really well. He goes through it step by step and tells you exactly why CHESS addresses those skills that I listed, like listening actively and speaking clearly, thinking critically and analytically. That's a big thing that CHESS does, and demonstrating personal management and teamwork skills, and you can read that at your leisure. We're always striving to improve our program, so I also included a copy of an innovative project that we started about a year ago to get kids thinking about the thinking they do when they're playing chess so they can transfer those skills to other aspects of their lives. So we put together a committee of teachers, coaches, and other educators to come up with the cognitive and non-cognitive skills that chess that are used in chess, and we have our lesson plans, our 30 lessons, so our lesson plans are designed for non-chess players, so some of our teachers don't know how to play chess, but we took every one of those 30 lessons, categorized those skills, and you'll see it in the document, said what cognitive skill does this lesson teach. We're gathering stories from coaches and principals and teachers to put into our lesson plans so that can be taught at the same time we're teaching chess. So in summary, Chess for Success teaches students the lifelong skills necessary to become productive members of society, and we're preparing students for the future. They're the future workforce. I added a budget to show you where we spend our money. It costs us about $3,000 a school, which is unheard of in the world of education. The average after-school educational program costs $1,000 a kid. And I also... we had our video, but it didn't work. But it's on our website. If you want to go to our website, www.chessforsuccess.org, you'll see it there. Thank you very much for the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you both. So these are just in Title I schools?
Yes.
And did you say it's about $3,000 per year per grade school?
Per a club, yes.
So presumably if you got a grant or a private donation, you could if somebody said, I want to do this for, say, Raleigh Hills grade school?
If they're not Title I, but if they were.
I mean,
yes. $3,000 would fund a school. The biggest cost is the teacher. Mm-hmm. That's our biggest cost, as you'll see in that budget. We think that's very important because teachers know how to teach. They're adult role models, and if we use people who really know how to play chess, they have no classroom management skills, and you can't get 115 kids to sit down. And we have several clubs with 130 in them, one in Beaverton.
Well, we do have some of the districts have Redmond did that, right? Some of the districts have come to us. They say we want, because people want this program. We're known all over the state because we're on the state tournament, and also people know about the program. So we've even stopped our waiting list, but. We've had some districts that have come to us and said, Monmouth too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Said, we Reynolds. Want the program. We said, well, our budget's too small. We can't do it. And they said, we'll get the money. If we get the money, will you do it? So we've had Reynolds School District, Redmond, and Monmouth have actually come to us to ask us to put it in and have gotten, was it 21st Century Grants or various mm-hmm. things to fund it. So, you know, the schools want it. I mean, if Bill Gates, you know, plopped down $1 billion, we put this not just in Title I, we put it in all the schools, but we have to make a decision on where to allocate our limited funds. So Title I seems to be the best place to stick it.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make a comment, if I can, about what Mr. Margolin was saying about the diversity of the program. And I have a little bit of personal experience because both my kids played on teams, and I spent a lot of time at chess tournaments, which my daughter always thought was funny because it was the only place where the boys had to stand in line for the bathrooms and the girls didn't. But there's something very interesting about watching a little girl beat a big boy in a game, because that doesn't happen very often, where you can have a young girl and beating a boy who's several grades ahead in a game, a board game. And it really does change the dynamic of of the perception of students and their ability to succeed. It really is an equalizer in that, especially with the kids who may not be succeeding in some other areas, and especially with the kids who, like Beaverton, for example, as you know, Mr. Chair, has I think about 90 languages spoken in the schools. They don't have to speak the same language. They just sit down and focus and have communication through playing the game. So it really is quite remarkable what can be done with such a little.
Do you have time for me to tell one anecdote that really?
That's up to the chair.
Okay, this is, I love to tell this, especially when I'm trying to raise money, but it's a great story. You know, the worst thing in the world that you can make a fifth grade boy do is do anything with a girl. And the way it works is in the chess club, there's a 15-minute lesson, and then the coach divides up the players to play. And this fifth-grade boy was told he had to play a third-grade girl. Now, not only was she a third-grade girl, but she had cerebral palsy. She was wheelchair-bound. She looked weird. She drooled. And this kid just didn't want to have anything to do with that. So the coach says, that's who you're playing. So he was forced to do it. Comes back about 20 minutes later, he lost. And he says, wow, she can play. So all of the differences disappeared in 20 minutes. You know, all of the things that she's a girl, she's a freak, she's this. Chess is how well you play the game. And the kid, all of a sudden, have respect for someone that he would have run a mile to get away from. So we have a lot of other stories about similar types of things that happen, and it's really just sort of amazing some of the unexpected things that happen in the chess by having kids play chess. So, well, thank you very much. We've really appreciated this opportunity.
It's marvelous. Thank marvelous. You. Appreciate it very much. And please keep us in mind, us committee members, when you're coming up with that new book.
Well, it depends on what kind of results.
Hello.
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julie mentioned the report. I do have a copy. I am going to place it on the shared drive, and you folks can, because it is 99 pages, but you will have access to it as you desire.
Okay. Mr. Chair, maybe we could, since it's only $75 per, it might be a good investment to see that everyone in Ways and Means next session has their chessboard and as they evaluate all the possibilities and the end results, it might be helpful.
Sometimes I wonder. It might be better.
Okay, Study Oregon, Promoting Oregon as an Educational Destination. This is an informational hearing. We have Teeter Kaplan, Amy Akimoff, Julie Walken.
And Julie, is this in addition to the stuff that I already submitted, that distributed?
No, this is just a copy.
Okay, great.
Okay, great. We'll get started. Thank you. My name is Teeter Kaplan, and I work at Chemeketa Community College in international programs. But I'm here today not as an individual or even a representative of my institution, but we're here to give you an informational session on Study Oregon, the consortium that we have. But first, I want to set the tone and give you a little bit of national information in your handouts. You will note that we gave you the Open Doors 2010 Fast Facts. There's an International Students in the United States page. I'd like you to go to that first. And specifically, if you'll look at the item B, the international student trends over the last years, I'd like you to take a look at the dip that occurs right after about what they call 9900, so 2001, post-September 11, 2001. And that dip continued on until about 2006, according to the stats. So what I'd like you to note is that currently today in the U.S., international education is the fifth largest service industry, import industry, and it estimates at about $20 billion into the U.S. economy each year, $20 billion. So we wanted to talk a little bit about the nearly 70% of the students that are coming here. Their funding, 70% of those students' funding comes from their personal funds, their government funds, or university scholarships back home in their home country, again, coming into the United States economy. And this money is trickling down not just to the institutions of higher education, intensive English language programs, and high schools throughout the United States, but into our communities through housing, food, car purchases, et cetera. So along with the bottom line dollars that this industry brings, of course, it
for us, fundamentally, it brings in the international relations, improving global intercultural skill sets, not just for those involved in the businesses directly, but those of us in the community as well. And as economics are the way they are today, it is essential, of course, we feel, for the competition and innovation for our societies. So it's important that people like even the three of us here on this panel and the student that we'll introduce to you have had the opportunity ourselves. There's three of us. We've studied in seven different countries and gone over multiple times to some of those countries as students ourselves, and then again later on as business endeavor trying to reach out to bring students to the United States. And if you look also, we'll switch over to the Oregon stats. The Open Doors fact sheet, which is a separate page, indicates that in Oregon we have currently, based on the Open Doors 2010 report, 7,506 students in this state. And that's an approximate estimate based on reporting. You'll notice the top schools and what their numbers are. I will note that the community colleges are kind of underrepresented in reporting it sometimes because of the way the management works, but I checked with, like, for example, Portland Community College, and last year they had over 300 international students. So the stats are changing for the types of institutions that attract these students as well. So the cooperation is great between our schools and our institutions, and that notes to you what the top countries are that we receive in this state. But I will note that we have over 90 countries throughout the state of Oregon coming here to get an education, and their families have poured their investment into those students and the students' future as they return to their country with an education from the U.S. But they also affect all of our college students. So if you think of those 7,500 students going around throughout the communities of Oregon, in rural Oregon as well as urban Oregon, they affect each and every college student, high school student, and community member that they interact with. So if you look briefly, you want to go to? Yes, great. So if you look briefly at that Oregon piece, for example, top senders, China, India, South Korea, previously it's been Japan, currently it's Saudi Arabia. We also have a connection there in business and industry. Obviously, as our trade partner, China, number one trade partner now, and the students that we bring in now, those students, as they continue on, finish their education, will then provide a direct link for people in Oregon to the business opportunities with our trade partners overseas as they return to home country. So we, all of our institutions stay connected with our alumni. I know that University of Oregon, for example, has a network of alumni throughout Japan that they meet with. Community colleges too, Oregon State University, and those connections continue on for years and years. So it's our goal to give you a little bit of information now about how Study Oregon as a consortium is trying to increase the outreach we have overseas, especially since, given post-September 11th, 2001, there are national strategies for recruitment in countries like the United Kingdom, Australia, Japan, France, that are getting that market share. And it's much more competitive for us to try and get those students. So unlike in the previous years, we would sit back and wait for inquiries to come in, now we have to go out and get them. We have to find those students. We have to build those relationships, and we have to make that investment. And we're very proud that Study Oregon has been helping us as institutions work together to make that investment. So I'm going to refer now to Julie to give you an update about the consortium itself.
Hello, Chair Haas and committee members. My name is Julie Walken, and I'm at Oregon State University. And I'm also Chair of Study Oregon this year, and We'll share with you kind of some key points about Study Oregon, but just to let you know, too, that really our goal here is to share with you the fact that we are working together collaboratively, and we're not necessarily requesting any fund appropriations at this, you know, time, but rather we really want to emphasize the importance of how all of our institutions and our communities view international student enrollment and being a host to international students, along with developing a core our Oregonian students and their tertiary goals. So the first point I do want to make is that unlike probably Texas, New York, and California, when it comes to awareness of tertiary educational opportunities, Oregon isn't as well known as other states, and certainly that's reflected in statistics. But we all know that we have some excellent institutions. We offer a diverse array of majors and degree offerings, and so there's a tremendous amount that we do offer and need to be promoting on a global scale so that there is greater awareness. So probably some, has it been about 15 years that Study Oregon has existed, so our origins are in the mid-90s. We've worked in collaboration with the U.S. Department of Commerce, U.S. Department of State, and we've received a great deal of support also from the Oregon Business Development Department, now known as Business Oregon. We currently consist of some 22 institutions in the state of Oregon. Altogether, there are some 45 accredited tertiary institutions. So there are there's room for growth, and we may have additional institutions joining us in the coming years as we certainly pool our resources and in a way can exhibit a greater impact, obviously, than simply relying on one school's own efforts alone. We do represent, as Sater mentioned, two-year, four-year, as well as graduate and professional schools, both public and private. And the goal is certainly that we raise increase visibility about Oregon, but with the understanding that it will be each individual institution's responsibility to carry out their own recruitment efforts. One of the key pieces that we wanted to share with you today is, in fact, our latest initiative. How do you reach a world of over 6 billion and of that a subset who are interested in pursuing their studies in the United States? Certainly that takes a lot of print and postage. If you use the yesteryear snail mail approach. But what we have done this year has actually become the first state consortium. There are other state consortia, by the way, Study Washington, Study Iowa, Destination Indiana, all working collectively to increase visibility. And what we have done with Study Oregon is to launch what is, we hope, a wow effect electronic brochure. We are so fortunate in Oregon that we are so incredibly a picturesque place to wow with the photographs. So as you can see, if I can, let's see, fit the screen. There we go. Is just to just briefly show you, if I can. Adjust the size. Let's see. That will zoom. No. Forgive me for a moment as I'm trying to decrease the screen size just a bit. Hmm. But But we do need the full screen size. Interesting. We have not encountered this in all of our testing.
Because you've never been to hearing room C.
Magical qualities. Okay. Well, if I could just read for you the opening statement. We are quite proud of the fact that we have a number of government ministers, university presidents, Pulitzer Prize winning poets, a Nobel Prize winner, astronauts, U.S. ambassadors to other countries, and CEOs of major U.S. and international companies that all have this thing in common, and that is that they studied in the state of Oregon. And we want people to know this and recognize that there's tremendous potential here in the state of Oregon. Through this interactive map, we sort of allow a prospective student, their parents, counselors, an opportunity to become familiarized with the state of Oregon, to envision what a beautiful place it is, as we describe all sorts of other features about the state, the degree of safety and friendliness and all the wonderful outdoor recreational opportunities that exist. Certainly, this is something that we are going to encourage any of you with us today to explore further and go into some of these expanding boxes that do explain what an extraordinary environment Oregon is, how globally connected we are. And in fact, we have a welcome letter from Governor Kulongoski, and we're just very happy to be able to use this to outline how fantastic our higher education opportunities are and our research and innovation that is unique to Oregon. Not to mention that we have some really kind of progressive activities. I do want to outline the OUS-approved tuition remission program known as International Cultural Service Program. I think perhaps one of the most progressive in the country that helps to support international students from diverse backgrounds who then become cultural ambassadors. This is a program that I constantly brag about as I travel to various parts of the world representing my institution and the fact that Oregon and our public education system offers such a program that benefits both the communities and the students. And then the last feature I'm going to mention is just that it does provide a fantastic way for people to identify where, if, for example, they wanted to study, I'm going to choose computer science. There it is. Again, if we had the full screen, but it actually identifies for you which institutions will offer that major and at that particular degree level. Again, we're trying to create efficiencies to help people really understand and explore what is offered in the state of Oregon. Finally, the remaining pages actually give you an institutional profile, beginning with Chemeketa, ending with Willamette University, MBA. So there are a multitude of ways to explore visually and through various text and expanding boxes and in some cases videos to engage students to see the big picture and to be keen on coming to Oregon, wherever that may be. And we know that will benefit all of us. So with that introduction, I'm going to ever so briefly just mention that there are a great number of other initiatives. They're outlined here as in the case of our largest national association for international educators, where we host a reception, again, highlighting the state of Oregon, our tertiary educational opportunities, in many cases to the Education USA advisors who are representing U.S. education in connection with U.S. embassies overseas. We've even begun to host networking workshops with high school college admissions counselors here in the state of Oregon, where we're beginning to see increasing numbers of secondary level students with international backgrounds. And in the interest of time, I will transition to Amy Akamoff from Willamette University, who will introduce a student. And I'll get
microphone to her. Thank you.
So this is a great opportunity for us to introduce to you an actual real live international student who is here in Salem. We represent both myself and Usama. We are from Willamette University's MBA program. Happens to be 40% international, coming from 25 different countries. So a pretty high percentage of international students coming from all over the world. Just speaking very quickly on how our students contribute to the community, we offer a really unique program where we partner our students with public and nonprofit organizations in the Portland and Salem area to give them a hands-on experiential learning experience in management within a real public or nonprofit organization. Our students actually work as a consulting team to these organizations and add value through their experience. Usama can talk a little more about his experience personally, but just as an example, our students have worked with Habitat for Humanity, Mercy Corps, Special Olympics, the Marion County Juvenile Department, to add value to those organizations. Not only do our international students contribute to communities, but their presence really provides an opportunity for cross-cultural dialogue between U.S. and international students to better understand and find solutions to global issues. So we think this is a really important piece of our education system. So I'd like to introduce Usama. His name is Usama Lakhdar Ghazal. He's actually a dual citizen from Morocco and France. He studied in undergrad in Morocco in finance and computer science. And now he's a very active student in our MBA program, studying specifically in operations systems and analysis. I'm now going to hand it over to Usama.
Thank you. Okay. So as they mentioned, there are a couple of ways that we add value as internationals. And besides the numbers and the investment and all the money that we bring in into this country, I think the most important thing is that we help and bring perspective. During the space program, I worked with a team of 9 other people. And we worked with KMUZ. I don't know if you heard about this community radio station that's trying to start here in Salem. And we help those people, nonprofit organizations, because most of the time, nonprofit people have a passion and they have an idea, but they like the business background and they think that nonprofit doesn't need to make money. So we help them out, and we bring perspective, being French with all the stereotypes that it carries. I bring some social perspective to some people that are maybe not that concerned about social aspects of their lives. Another program that we have at the university is the Language in Motion program, in which all internationals, to my knowledge, we have all participated in that program, and I'm again participating tomorrow in North Salem High School, where we go to classes of high school where they learn our languages. Tomorrow I'm going to a French class, share about French holidays and French way of celebrating Christmas and New Year, and the differences that it may happen between France and Morocco. Morocco not being a Christian country, we don't celebrate Christmas, and carry this message and bring this perspective to those high school students. I think it's really important to see that there is an impact that we have, and we are happy to do it. That's the main thing. I mean, we came here, I came here to study, to get a good education. I'm not saying that France doesn't have a good education, but it was my perspective to come and travel, take advantage. I've been told by my parents to travel while I was young, so I'm trying to do that. And it's willingly that we share and help people around us. We have, as Amy mentioned, around 20 countries represented, and it's in a global world, in the global world in which we're living, I think it's crucial to understand each other. It would save a lot of problems and it would save a lot of conflicts when you know that a Chinese person never says no but says yes, but you understand better how to communicate. And when a French person says no straight away, you understand why, and it facilitates communication in this global world, I believe.
So with that, we'll open it up for questions if you have any.
Thank you all. I'm stunned at that fifth largest service industry in the country. You wouldn't think of it like that. It feels like economic development in that context.
And if I could just make a comment, and I so appreciate Osama. This is the highlight, and truly, I think for so many of us who may have been in this field for some 15, 20 years, it is because we had a very profound, transformative, international and intercultural experience. For me, it was actually within the U.S. with very dear, close friendships with other international students during my college experience. That is where the true passion is. But we recognize, too, that in this global environment, that focusing on just the importance, even with respect to the bottom line, that can sometimes be how we help engage others to recognize the value. But ultimately, very much like the success for chess, yeah, or chess for success, sorry, I think some of the same skill sets that were outlined are very much true for international education too, that we become much more complex thinkers when we've had an opportunity to, oh my goodness, encounter someone who has had a very different upbringing and who has maybe different cultural assumptions that lead to very different a way of life, a way of thinking, a way of coming to solutions, as Amy mentioned. So it is, there's so much that's immeasurable, or you could say priceless, about international educational exchange. And I just think that Oregon is a very special place, and the more that we can foster international educational exchange, which includes being a very welcoming and supportive environment for international students, the better we will all benefit, ultimately.
Mr. Chair, I'd just point out that there have been some very fine people that have graduated from Willamette University.
I agree.
We thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I think rather than take a break, we'll just go through these remaining two items. Unless anyone objects to that. And we have the School Facilities Task Force report. And I think Ruth Scott, Chris Dudley, Ruth Scott.
Actually, it will be Elise Calabayo and Bruce Murray.
Okay.
Who's the chairs?
Good morning, Chair Haast and committee members. I am Bruce Murray, 4110 Southwest Patrick Place in Portland, and I am a founding board member of the Center for Innovative School Facilities. While now retired, my career included 25 years as a commercial banker financing real estate developers across the country, and 3 years as the first director of real estate for the Chicago Public School System when Mayor Daley took over. First and most important, please accept our thanks for your leadership in the 2009 legislative session when you authorized the creation of the School Facility Task Force and gave it the charge to measure the problem and recommend standards and funding mechanisms. We at the Center very much thank you for this leadership. The Center for Innovative School Facilities is a nonprofit with more than 100 volunteer real estate design and construction industry professionals like myself. You have made our challenging mission much easier with your legislation. I would like to take just a couple minutes to give you some background on the issue. First, as your handouts detail, the center's mission is to advance student performance by improving place and community. We are clear that quality teaching is the most important component of education. We are also clear that quality facilities impact achievement, and more importantly, that quality facilities are the rising tide that lifts all boats, improving both teaching and learning. The center's statewide focus is twofold: to assist school districts in making facility improvements that have the most impact on achievement, and improving energy conservation that saves operating dollars, thus freeing up funds for the classroom. Oregon, unlike most states, has virtually no support for school facilities. The center is determined to change that situation, but not at the expense of the classroom. Rather, we are determined to establish a program and separate funding for facilities that augments rather than steals from education funds. Oregon students equally across the state deserve to learn in the environments that strengthen their achievement. Our second focus is saving money in operations. Buildings built before 2000 that have not been retrofitted are energy hogs. Oregon schools total almost 94 million square feet, or 1,600 football fields. The money spent operating these buildings is better spent in our classrooms. And the money spent fixing these issues creates needed jobs today. The State Facility Task Force you established has worked diligently over the past months to develop a path for change. Their plan, completed this past spring, breaks this very large and complex issue into reasonable and doable phases. The center, as a group of volunteers working to help Oregon school districts, are strongly supportive of the plan the task force has developed, and we encourage its completion at every opportunity. We urge their continued work for two reasons. In May, Oregon voters passed Measures 68 and 69, adding K-12 school facilities to Oregon's bonding authority, and Governor-elect Kitzhaber is proposing a school weatherization fund. Both actions are good news for Oregon's cash-starved school facilities. We recognize today's conflicting challenges, that Oregon's bonding capacity is limited, and that the tight budgets and deferred maintenance over the past two decades have created a backlog of school districts with urgent, needed facility upgrades. Our critical barrier to an equitable solution is that, unlike most states, we do not have a publicly accessible inventory or database of the status of our state school facilities. The database is needed to set priorities for state bonds or any other school funding mechanism. Specifically, Oregon needs an information database that will capture the size of the problem and provide a baseline for distribution of funds in a transparent manner. It is logical and essential that decisions on the allocation of funds for facilities be data-driven. Without data, and with the extreme backlog of need, litigation inequities will be difficult to avoid. We urge your continued support of the School Facility Task Force. Thank you.
Chairperson Haas and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Luis Caraballo, and I am the chair of the statewide task force we finally refer to as House Bill 2013 Task Force. When I'm not serving in a volunteer capacity on task force, I am the director of facilities and planning for the Salem-Keizer Public Schools. I, as well, would like to thank the committee for your wisdom in creating the task force and bringing some positive focus and policy discussion around the critical issues of our school's infrastructure. We were before your committee in January of this year at your request to talk to you about the plan of action that we were rolling out, as we had been in existence for all of a month at that time. True to the plan that we shared with you at that time, that we were going to go to the February interim session and report on what our plan of action was, we moved forward and gave them a context of who the members were and where we were headed. Receiving no objections, we moved forward and put together a plan of action that then was moved forward to the May Emergency Board to seek the release of some of the money that had been appropriated through House Bill 2012. And due to the financial challenge that the state is facing, that has been put on hold. So in the interim, the task force has continued nonetheless to move forward in terms of trying to put structures in place in the event that any of the resource would be available, that we could move forward with that plan of action in terms of trying to meet any component of the charge that you had placed in the House bill before us. To date, none of the money has been made available, but because of the resiliency of the membership of the task force, we nonetheless have continued to find ways to try to use the information that you've asked for as a vehicle for which we can begin to present to you some of the continuing issues of concern, which simply are just not going to go away and will be exacerbated in time, given the financial choices that are having to be made at the local level. So the task force, without the resource, continues to want to spend its time addressing some real key issues. First and foremost, we are going to be requesting, oh, haven't found the vehicle yet, to have an extended life of the task force so that we can continue the policy discussion. The task force currently is set to sunset at the end of next calendar year, but there's a lot of work that through the volunteer portions of groups like the center, as well as those of us that, through other organizations, can continue to bring solid information to this committee and to others in terms of dealing with these issues into the future. Likewise, our committee has begun in collaboration with the center to try to create some guidelines, some norms. When you asked us to measure the conditions of facilities across the state, the first question that came to us as experts was, what metric, what barometer would you like for us to use? And what we found was that there is no singular or not even a suggestion of what we should find in terms of the core basis in schools. So each district self-defines. So it makes it hard to measure between district and district. You can measure certainly the efficiency or inefficiency of a building, but the core piece is it achieved the goal of educational success. And so, again, we've been working very, very closely with the center and others to try to create some of those standards and use those as a benchmark against which we can measure when resources become available to measure the brick and mortar. The group is also going to be working very diligently in terms of trying to work with what guidelines we would provide both the legislature and the treasurer's office around rollout of Measure 68, as that will be critical for those of us in the day-to-day business, that a corpus adequate enough for actual the charge of the public through Measure 68 can be found, and that it's also equitable. When you look at large districts like ours who have the capacity to do bonding at levels, there is some incentive, but it's actually, we've discovered that it's the smaller districts who don't even have the bonding capacity to build a building that do need to take advantage of this. So we're going to want to work and making sure that gets designed in a mechanism that is successful for them into the future. Again, we also believe that we need a centralized repository somewhere to capture at least what information is presently there, even if we can't revisit it in terms of the charge you gave us in the original bill. There are a lot of surveys and a lot of analyses that have been done. Our district certainly did one in prelude to the bond measure that we passed in 2008, and we'd like to have a place where that can be centrally located and used by many so that folks can understand the state of the infrastructure across the state as best we can find. And lastly, we want to continue to be sort of the conscience of the legislature on these issues. One of the things that we've talked to you and other committees about is, again, we think you have been very forward-thinking in creating this task force for this policy discussion, as many other states have found themselves in the same place, but as an outcome of litigation. We believe that that's a lose-lose proposition. So, again, we want to be in front of you, trying to bring to you positive solutions, even in this resource-challenged environment, so that we can continue to move these issues forward in a very positive fashion, because they are critical to the success of our kids in our districts on a day-to-day basis. That, in a nutshell, is kind of where we've been and where we're at, and we're glad to answer any questions.
Appreciate that. Committee, you know that one of the LCs we're hopefully adopting here today to be introduced would extend the task force for two more years. I suspect that we'll probably bring you all back in after the session starts to this committee, and then we'll vote on that and send it to Ways and Means where those decisions will be made down the road. Questions? Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Appreciate it greatly. Okay, and I'd like to open an informational hearing on supporting student success. An update on the grant from Beth. She's here.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to be here this morning and to share with you some of the work that we've done over the last 18 months. I am Beth Unverzat. I'm the director of Oregon After School for Kids, which is the statewide network for after-school programs. We're a collaboration of state agencies and statewide associations that have an interest in expanded learning opportunities that happen outside the bell. We also provide technical assistance and support to the Department of Education 21st Century programs, and we're part of the national network of after-school networks. So there are 39 states that have developed after-school networks, and we've received technical assistance and support from national organizations. So in May of 2009, the National Governors Association and the Council of Chief State School Officers and the National Conference of State School Legislators offered a grant to the networks to work with policymakers around expanded learning opportunities. We were one of five states that received this grant. And so we pulled together some key stakeholders, and I want to thank those key stakeholders for their time and energy and brain power to begin to frame a very complicated issue. In your packet, you see a list of the names of those people. So in our discussion today, I'm going to attempt to lay a framework of information that we've learned in the last 18 months and where we think this needs to go. So in your packet, there's a document titled Expanded Learning Opportunities and a definition. This definition has basically been adopted on the national level to include a what, when, and quality. So the definition is the practice of providing children and youth with activities outside the school day to expand their learning. There are four columns in your what. So that's youth development, recreation, child care, and education. I think there's a fifth column after our 18 months, and that would be the content providers. You heard from one this morning, Test for Success. There are others, a.k.a. science, mad scientists, robotics. So those are really the content providers that come into after-school programs. And the when is really before school, after school, weekends, anytime school's not in session. So our process involved eight working meetings over a period of 18 months with an outside facilitator and research and data collection by Oregon Ask and analysis by Cedar Lake Research. So what we did was we looked at the world of after-school expanded learning opportunities and what is best practice. So best practice tells us that the minimum intensity of service is no fewer than 12 hours a week or 3 days a week. So that is what we counted. We did not count single activity programs. We did not count sports. We did not count separate. So we actually took a look at it and said, where are programs? So we built on some data that we had collected in 2008 with the support of Spirit Mountain Community Fund and Education Northwest, determining the kinds of questions that we would ask to programs. And then when we received the Supporting Student Success Grant, we got support from the Department of Education and from the Child Care Division to actually build and create a database. So we've built the database. We've put in data from the Department of Education, school locations, number of children. We took in the poverty and minority by school district. We looked at the nutritional support pieces that come from USDA, both snack and supper. And so we put all of this in there, and then we went to our partners at Boys and Girls Clubs, the Y's, the Park and Recreation Association, all of the programs that provide, and we gathered information from them. We did it by age group, and we did it by location. And then we called every single school in this state, and we talked to them. And we said, where are your children going when they're not in school? In doing that, we found some very interesting data. And so in your packets, there are some maps that I'd like to refer you to. And so the maps basically show by county, the programs that are available. So our program count, okay, again, 12 hours a week or more, 3 days a week or more, we've identified 800 programs that currently operate in this state. They're sponsored by the multiple organizations. They all have some similarities, but one of the interesting pieces is that 84% of these programs actually take place in school buildings. So that was an important thing to learn. Generally, access is less than 20% of Oregon KA students in cities. The rate is lower for suburbs, towns, and lowest in rural settings. There are fewer than 10% of students that have access to expanded learning opportunities. At the low-income access is a big issue. So schools where 50% or more of the students are eligible for free and reduced lunch, 16.6 of K-5 and only 11.1 of grades 6 through 8 have access to expanded learning. At the same time, we did two reports for the Commission for Child Care around the programs that operate in schools and had discussions with program providers, and we would be happy to provide those two reports to you because they show the perspective from the programs. So the S3 group looked at these documents and the information that we gathered. You can clearly see that we don't have programs in 6th through 8th grade. The models for expanded learning opportunities look different at every different level, in elementary, middle, and high school. We were not able to collect the same kind of data for high school because in high school it is more single activity and it's linked to career-related pieces. We have programs in K-5. So the overall student access varies by geographic area. The data presented in Figure 2 shows the city, suburban, town, rural, and the percentage of students by socioeconomic status. I think one of the key pieces here is that children who are living in poverty have less access. And perhaps those are the children that need this the most. So we have a lot of data that we've collected. We can actually sort and sift it in a variety of ways. So all of the information was presented to the S3 group, and we've basically come up with a summary of barriers and challenges. There are six of them. The first one is that we lack a common vision shared by schools, municipalities, businesses. Research actually shows us that 86% of voters think that after-school programs are valuable. This is an issue that is across silos and very deep. So it affects every community. We're trying to solve it in a variety of ways, but on the state level, we lack a vision for what it looks like for caring for our children and providing them these rich, wonderful opportunities. So in that, the cooperation and collaboration across systems is a priority. And this is between agencies and systems that actually administer multiple funding streams related to school-aged children and youth. Also, program capacity. We've identified 800 programs, but most of them, there are still hundreds of children in those schools who could have those opportunities, and there are additional schools that need to have programs. Transportation is another huge issue. In the process after the data collection, I actually had conversations with 21 different school districts. So after we sorted the data, we looked at the highest poverty, highest minority school districts, and I called them and I asked them questions. So the superintendents had great responses, and their number one issue was, we don't have transportation. They clearly understand the need for expanded learning opportunities. We also found, which was, I thought, very interesting, that a lot of school districts are using Title I funds outside of school time. And so then our number five barrier was nutritional support. So this is kind of a low-hanging fruit piece because we're one of 14 states that receives special money from the Department of Agriculture through our Department of Education for after-school supper. And we have more schools that would qualify to actually receive the supper program than are currently on it. One of the things that Oregon Ask has done over the last 5 years is to really work on making those connections and supporting USDA in outreach to school districts. We have seen a 33% increase by conversations that we've had with school districts. Very specifically, I can say Salem-Keizer, 4 years ago, was not on after school supper. Last year, they served 64,000 meals, supper meals, to children in this city. So we can duplicate that and see. This is an unlimited resource. It should be taken advantage of. So we would encourage some further conversation around that. And then number six, with investment strategies. So these identified federal funding streams are not utilized in cooperation and collaboration. We currently have $10 million that comes into the state that's dedicated for after school through 21st century. 135 programs last year received that money. That was reduced by 32 programs this year. It's a five-year grant. It is decreases over the 5 years. And we think that there's opportunity for collaboration within those funding streams, both within the department and then cross-agency. So our recommendations are that and we would request that you would establish an expanded learning opportunities task force. We've completed our 18 months. We have a report that will come to you with all of this data and more. But we see that there are a lot of missed opportunities in this for collaboration between schools and communities. So we would like to see additional data system coordination and identify better opportunities for integration with the existing funding streams, establish relationship of current after-school programs in the school day, review the best practices in content area, and explore the costs and barriers to implementing them in after-school, examine evaluation processes, examine ways to supplement and develop the after-school workforce.
You're reading that from the LC we have in front of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. And then the other recommendations would be the nutrition initiative. This is, I think, on a return on investment would be an incredible one because of the number of programs that the schools that could actually go on to after school supper that currently are on snack and feed hungry children. So there is a second LC that is the Nutrition Initiative with $175,000 for grants because we identified the barriers that programs have to get on to supper and $75,000 for administration and support for training for programs. For us, this is just the beginning of the data collection piece. There's a tremendous amount of data collection that needs to continue. We really need to actually look at the workforce itself. Who are the people that are working with children and youth? What are the barriers for them residing within school buildings? And there are many. There are also a need to look at, and we've identified some of our highest need children and youth that reside within the housing authorities and housing and community services. We did not count them. We've been having some conversations with the policy people at housing on how to actually make those connections. So the underrepresented population, housing authority being part of that, and then workforce and also parents. So we want to do some additional data collection around those three very specific areas while looking at the agency funding streams and how we might be able to find some collaboration. So I'm open for any questions. And
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to recognize Patty Whitney, two other members of the S3 team, Patty Whitney Wise from the Hunger Relief Task Force and Karina Lemons from the Salem Kaiser Education Foundation have joined us, so I want to recognize them. So.
We do have your LC, and we are going to adopt it with some other bills for introduction momentarily.
Okay.
Thank you for that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, committee, that clears our calendar with the exception of some other bills. We probably should have done this all at once, but we didn't. So let me close the informational hearings and open up a work session. And Senator Morris, do you have a list of the bills that we still have to do? This.
Okay. Are we ready?
We're ready.
Mr. Chair, I move LC numbers 1289, 1290, 1875, 2638, 2762, 3009, 290, and 1728 be introduced as committee bills.
Senator Morris moves that LCs 1289, 1290, 1875, 2638, 2762, 3009, 290, and 1728 be introduced as committee bills. Any objections? Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none? So ordered. Okay. That does clear our agenda. This is the final meeting here. I want to say goodbye to two guys who have been active and very helpful and thoughtful participants. Senator Metzger is going on to bigger and better things. Senator Cruz, I'm going to spend the rest of the day trying to find out whether you wanted off this committee or the Senate President took you off for the next session.
That has been a subject of discussion the last couple of days.
Okay. Anyway, thanks to both of you and good luck in the future. We are adjourned.
All right. Thank you.